AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
The most challenging part of the whole process was after the surgery. It just seemed so poignant and emblematic of kind of what I'd done and what I'd achieved. And, you know, the two guys that were in hospital with me recovering in St. Thomas's, the one guy, young guy next to me, who was funnily enough from Brighton, he had the TP as well. And in the interim, both of those two passed away, you know? I lost both of them. And we become quite good friends while we're in hospital. And I kind of looked up at the sky and just remembered them.
Welcome to Stoma for Life, the Bowel Cancer Awareness and Life as an Ostomate radio show and podcast. Your host, Rafaela, is here to debunk myths, clear up misconceptions, and help you approach the subject that so many people are afraid to talk about in a positive manner. Listen in for a new perspective. Stoma for Life on UK Health Radio.
Once again, hello and welcome to Stoma for Life. If this is your first time tuning in, this show is here to shine a light on the real experiences of living with a stoma, breaking down stigma, sharing stories, and reminding every ostomate that you are never alone. This October, the show is being taken over by Danzig. While many know them for creating high-quality pouching systems, their work is about so much more. Danzig is dedicated to dignity, empowerment, and supporting ostomates everywhere to live with confidence and comfort. It's a mission I connect with on all fronts as somebody who has relied on their products since the very first bag change. October is also the month we mark with World Ostomy Awareness Day, on the 4th of October to be exact. First launched in 1993 by the International Ostomy Association, it takes place every 3 years and is now recognized in more than 40 countries around the world. Its purpose is simple, yet vital: to raise understanding of what it really means to live with a stoma, to educate both the public and professionals, and to challenge the stigma that still exists. Danzig's theme this year, Empowering Ostomates Worldwide to Be Comfortable, says it all. It's about making sure every ostomate knows that they can live fully, proudly, and without limits. Because here's the truth, we are more than our stomas. We are people with a voice, passions, and a journey that deserves to be celebrated. And with Danzig's support this month, those voices are being heard more clearly than ever. Which brings me to today's very special guest. I'm delighted to welcome Ross Davidson, a fellow Danzig ambassador whose story has inspired people across the world. Ross hit the headlines when he cycled through Thailand with two stomas, showing that resilience, adventure, and determination don't stop after surgery. His journey is powerful proof that life with a stoma can still be bold, brave, and limitless, and in his case, with two stomas. I'm absolutely delighted to have you as the second guest in this special Danzig sponsored month. Welcome to Stoma for Life, Ross Davidson.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to join you and share my story.
Now, Ross, can you take us back to the beginning? What was life like for you before you had stoma surgery?
Wow. Well, I guess I'd always been physically active throughout my life. So that had kind of always been quite a strong background presence. I lived, you know, I lived around the world. I traveled a bit, and you know, just kind of lived my life, really. You know, enjoyed it, tried to live it to the full. I became a father in 2007. So we, you know, we had my partner and I, Joe. We had two kids that we were bringing up, and I was working in software sales. Nothing exciting, really. Just kind of, you know, a life down here in Brighton in the UK. And yeah, just things were kind of going along. I'd always been very reasonably, well, yeah, generally pretty healthy throughout my life. Never really had any serious health issues at all. Just kind of cruising along, I guess, really, in some ways. And then, yeah, and then I was kind of diagnosed.
You know, being diagnosed, that's for everyone or for anybody that's had a diagnosis, you know, it's a surreal experience and it's one that will stay with you forever. So surely you must have had symptoms preceding that actually got you as far as getting a diagnosis. Perhaps you can just share with us what led up to that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, they've been coming on for a while, really. I cycled back and forth to work every day. And I'm just trying to sort of put this in some kind of chronological order. I think I started to notice that I was losing a bit of weight, and the getting back to the cycling thing, I was noticing that it was what was had previously been a reasonably easy ride into work and back. It was kind of pretty flat. Was kind of becoming tougher. Like just sort of, oh, I've got no power in my legs, and I'd get home and I'd be exhausted. And, I was kind of pallid a bit, the color of my skin, my bowel habits were changing, just sort of having to go more frequently, just kind of a lot of fairly obvious signs. If I look back now, I think maybe perhaps, I'm not alone in this, in the fact that it was scary and I had it took a lot of strength. And almost in the end, coercion from my partner to get me to go to the doctor. I had to kind of face a sort of a lifelong fear of the doctor, which in a way I think maybe sort of made allowed the condition to progress a bit more than it should have. And that consequently fed into requiring a bit more radical surgery to cure me later on down the road.
So you were presented with what diagnosis?
It was stage 3, locally advanced rectal cancer, adenocarcinoma. So, yeah, it's funny. It wasn't when I, after all the testing and the biopsy and everything, and we had to go back in and see the surgeon for the results. It didn't come as a surprise to me. I kind of instinctively knew that it wasn't just something, that was going to go away. It was benign. I just instinctively knew that it was going to be cancer. So in a way, it was kind of just confirmation of what I knew.
Yeah.
Still tough, but a massive bolt out of the blue. I think I kind of understood. I kind of knew.
I always knew there was something more to what the doctors were telling me. That's why I kept pushing for colonoscopy.
Yeah.
They sent me home with an ointment and said, no, this is it. You just take this ointment and you'll be fine. And I knew there was something deeply wrong. I think it's great that you actually touched on this, that you knew there was something wrong. Because often we cast that inner voice aside. You have to come up to terms with it. And I don't know how it was for you, but when I did get the diagnosis, I actually felt relieved because it sort of, there is a diagnosis, there's a name for this, and now we can have a call of action.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had, getting back to the fear of doctors thing, it was actually a bit more than that. It was a very deep-rooted psychological aversion to, it was a fear of doctors, but it was more a fear of being treated for cancer that happened to me when I was a kid. I don't know why. It was just some weird thing that kicked in, and it was probably requires 100 hours of sessions with therapists to get to the bottom of that. But it was some thing that kicked in And I kind of lived with this sort of ogre in my mind all my life that really, really shaped who I was, and kind of living with a phobia, you know. So anytime I hear of anybody now who mentions a phobia, it doesn't have to be cancer. It can be anything irrational. I kind of have a very deep understanding of what it's like to live your life with something that is, to the outside, is quite rationally explained away and, you know, kind of dismissed. Yeah. But it just takes over your life. And so, like you, when I, you know, for a different reason, but when I was finally diagnosed, on the one hand, I had this, you know, I've got cancer. But on the other hand, having gone to the doctor and finally overcome this monstrous fear that I had of getting involved with any medical treatment and that had been taken away. So on the one hand, I was dealing with this, what was ahead of me with the cancer treatment. And yet I felt light because I'd had this almost, in a sense, it sounds strange, but in a weird way, it felt like I had come out better off than what I'd been carrying around with me.
Yeah.
And that sounds strange to say, but a 40-year accumulation of something that was eating away at you, it ain't much fun.
Absolutely.
And it changes you and it gets heavier and heavier as time goes on. And yeah. So it was almost like I said, just it was almost like I swapped to something that was at least real now and I could mm-hmm. face and deal with it.
Yeah.
And honest and open instead of psychologically hiding,
because that weighs down heavy on your life, the psychological part, because it's always there in the back of your head. I always say get clarity, get that peace of mind, because my thoughts are the ones that were toxic, and that's why I firmly believe I was diagnosed as well, because I had all these toxic thoughts, because we don't realize how detrimental your thoughts actually can be.
Yeah. I mean, and that goes for, you know, not just in relation to what we're discussing today, right? It goes far broader than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, I just want to take it a little further, because obviously you were diagnosed and you went into, I would presume, chemotherapy. And when were stomas ever, or stoma, because I'm saying stomas because you're going to still share what actually happened to you. Yeah. When was that actually on the cards? What happened after being diagnosed?
Well, I went to see, you know, had all the scans and everything and staging, and I have a feeling that my prognosis was probably a bit grim, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I think there was. You know, it was I became quite intensely involved with all the treatment plans. Some people I know kind of don't want to know about anything, right? But I was kind of the flip side. I was really like, wanted to know all the words and everything and vocabulary and all that kind of thing, what was going on. And I saw that it was curative. So the idea was that they were to cure me, which I guess, you know, I kind of took as a positive. But in the way, looking back now, it just seems like it means that there's, I wasn't a hopeless case in a sense, you know. So there was talk of potentially requiring surgery, right? Mm. And I think that you end up getting a bit better at judging what is meant by things that are said. So potentially requiring surgery could mean you're going to have surgery, or it could mean that we're going to try and get you operated on, but it may be inoperable, you know?
Yeah.
So that there was never any sort of talk about stoma bags or anything. It was just, we're going to try and kind of get you to surgery, into a surgical state, I think is what was going on. So, but then I started doing a bit of research about, you know, what could be expected from, you know, cancers in certain areas, and mine was low down in the rectum, so I knew immediately that there was at least going to be a stoma, right? And I kind of just prepared myself for that. But I kind of kept it out of my mind. I just wanted to stay strong while I was going through the chemo and the radiotherapy. And so I kind of stayed active as much as I could. But yeah, so there was no overt mention of stomas. The only time stomas were ever mentioned was when I actually found out what the, you know, what the surgical procedure is that they recommended.
And would you like to share with us what they actually then ended up doing?
Yeah, sure. So like I had, like I said, I had chemo radiotherapy, and then I had like sort of 3 months for my body to just kind of calm down from the assault. And then I was referred to a surgeon in London, specialist surgeon at St. Thomas's, which kind of rang a few alarm bells straight away, right? Because the surgery wasn't able to be performed in Brighton. And so I kind of went up there, you know, because the tumor had gone outside of my rectum and it was just threatening the prostate. So they wanted to get a check on him. So anyway, I saw him, Mark George, great guy, really straight up, straight down the line, you know, just kind of called it as it was, kind of, in a sense, it kind of at least brought clarity to the situation, right? And then he said that, you know, he recommended that I get what's called a total pelvic exenteration, mm-hmm. which is kind of as scary as it sounds, right?
Could you perhaps just explain to the listeners, for those that are not familiar with it, what it actually is?
Yeah, sure. So effectively, total pelvic exenteration means that they remove all the organs of your pelvis. So from a male perspective, that means your prostate, your bladder, your seminal vesicle, the sigmoid colon, the lower part, I think that's the right term, and the rectum. And because the tumor was so low, they had to remove my anus as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, pretty full on. Yeah. And so that left me with two permanent stomas, colostomy and a urostomy. I was on the table for 8 hours, three surgical teams. So it was, you know, the colorectal surgeon, the urology surgeon, and also there was a plastic surgery team as well to cover up, you know, the damage that was done to that part of me to, you know, make it smooth again, you know. So, pretty full on, really. Yeah.
Perhaps you can share with us what role of support did you have from family, friends, or the community? What support did you have during that time? Because, I mean, that's a very trying time. And I always say, you know, it's one of those times where you really know who's got your back.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I was at home with the kids, you know, and my partner. You know, we my son has autism, so he's communicative, but, you know, we had to sort of approach it differently with him. But we were basically just up front with both of them, told them what happened and what I was going to be going through. And I was going to try really hard to get well. So it was kind of a tough time, really. I mean, you know, my friends were supportive, had some good support at home. My family, who live in Canada, that's where the accent comes from, by the way, were great. And, you know, my friends were too. I think it's kind of weird. I think some people just don't know what to do, right? When somebody's in a situation like that, you know, like I can think the classic thing is, if there's anything I can do for you, just let me know. And so I think that you know, that obviously shows that they mean well, but I think people are a bit lost, right, in how to deal with that. And I don't know why. I think maybe in the sense when you see somebody who your age, it kind of quietly forces you to look at your own mortality as well. I don't know, you know, I think it kind of creates lots of things going on. But yeah, I just remember trying to sort of stay active and fit. You know, I was lifting weights and you know, I don't know. I just kind of, because of what I was mentioning earlier about this weight that would be removed from me, from the phobia, I kind of almost went into a different frame of life. And I was like, okay, I'm going to get strong through this. I don't know. Yeah. It was almost like, I mean, obviously it wasn't backed up by, you know, the medical facts, but in my head, it was like, okay, I've got through all of that. Now I'm going to get through this too.
Yeah.
I felt very strong and purposeful throughout it.
Yeah.
You know?
This is very powerful, what you've just mentioned, because we don't realize how powerful and how strong we can actually be until we get challenged.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's more, in your case, more like, well, I've gotten that t-shirt, you know, I've done that, I'm done with it. I've gone through it and I've come out on top.
But the most challenging part of the whole process, if you like, was after the surgery. Mm. That was horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, if I look back now, the treatment itself, it was a walk in the park compared to what I had to deal with afterwards, after the surgery.
Yeah.
So it was pretty tough.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Just for my understanding, what was the timeline? I mean, you are obviously, you've been in sport and fitness, what I could gather, all your life. And for somebody then all of a sudden just to be dependent on other people, helping them. I mean, my recovery was also quite lengthy, but obviously you had much, much more to go through. What did that recovery look like, and when were you able to actually pursue your passion, cycling, again?
Yeah, well, cycling had wasn't always my passion. It was more like running, just general fitness. I used cycling as a way of getting around, cycling to work and back. I used to do loads of running. Weights, you know, just active fit stuff. So then after the surgery, so the surgery was in March of 2019. So what, 6.5 years ago now. And then I was in hospital for like nearly 3 weeks and then came home, and it was just a very gradual, you know, recovery. I had to go back into hospital with a pelvic abscess, you know, from it. But I remember I went back to work on the 1st of July. I remember it was about 3.5 kilometers to work, and I walked in the first week quite slowly, and then I think around in the middle of July, so I guess maybe 3.5 months after my surgery, I got back on the bike, and you know, quite timidly really, but yeah, and I just started, and then work itself was really tough, you know, psychologically, being back in that environment after what I'd been through. And there were changes going on in the company as well. So then I kind of left after about a year and a half after that. And then I didn't know what to do really. But I had made this kind of, when I was recovering in hospital, I used to live in Japan teaching English, and I used to go to Thailand all the time. I loved the country. And while I was in my weird head state in hospital where I couldn't eat because I was being fed through, you know, TPN, is that TPN? Basically nutrition into your body because your bowels decided to go on strike for a few days. Yeah. And I was kind of like, I ended up watching these videos of this dude in Thailand who used to go around and videos of, you know, on YouTube of food in Thailand. So, and I was like, kind of planted this thought of, if I get through this, I'm going to get back out to Thailand one day. So that was there. And then after work, this does tie in, by the way. So then when I left my job, I didn't know what to do. And I actually went and decided I was going to qualify as a personal trainer. So I got my PT qualifications. And during that time, I was cycling a bit more every day to do this course. And then I was really enjoying the sort of freedom that came from the cycling. Because when I was on my bike, you know, I could forget about the bags. And it kind of made me feel like I was on a bit of a level playing ground again. You know, like, yeah. When you're walking around with two stomas, it becomes a little bit more deeply ingrained over time. But at first, you really were aware of this, you know, this change to your anatomy and your how you related to the world around you, and your brain was coming to terms with all of that. And I think there was a nice freedom of getting on the bike, because the nature of how you were, it was, you know, it was just less strain on it. And so I just, when I qualified, after I finished my qualification, I just kept going and riding further and further distances. And then I kind of got this idea of, well, look, let's see if I can combine the two. Let's see if I can take my bike to Thailand, you know, sort of, complete that promise I made to myself. So I started with that. I approached Hollister, Dan Sachs, partner company, all part of the same umbrella. There, I used their products and mentioned my idea about what I wanted to do. And they kindly sponsored me. And then the next thing, you know, I'm planning a 1,200 kilometer journey on my bike through the northwest of Thailand mountains. My brother and a good friend from Vancouver flew in. So we all met up in Bangkok. And we got on a night train, and hopped off in the middle of the country, got off at 4 a.m. in the middle of Thailand one day, and we just started cycling.
Wow.
And I set up a charity page for Bowel Cancer UK. It wasn't even my intention to do this for charity at first. I just kind of wanted to do it for myself, in a sense, to prove what I could do. But so many people were kind of inspired by it. They said, listen, you got to set up a charity, man. You got to let people know about this. So it was good. While I was actually, I think, in Bangkok before we got on this train, this night train, I set up a charity page, you know, I didn't massively promote it, but I think we raised about £2,500 for charity, which was great, because it was just kind of set up quickly on the spot. So it was great. A lot of people contacted other people about it, and it was great. And the last day of the sort of the main ride that we did, it was 990 kilometers. I still remember. And we did it in 9 days of cycling.
Wow. That's over 100 kilometers a day.
Yeah, exactly. 110 kilometers a day. And during that time we did nearly 16,000 meters of climbing. Of ascent. So it was a massive, massive undertaking. And on the final day, it was all very Hollywood. You know, we did this thing called a Mae Hong Son loop. It was a big loop up in through northwest Thailand near the border with Myanmar. And on the final day, we climbed up Thailand's highest mountain. And it was it was like a short ride. It was 48 kilometers, so 30 miles. And during that distance, we climbed 2,500 meters of elevation. It was by far and away the toughest climb I've ever done in my whole life.
I'm sure, and with a bike. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Cycled up, and I mean, it took us a while, but it was just so hugely, you know, emblematic. You know, as I crossed, they filmed me as I got to the top, Thailand's highest peak, and I wrote quite an emotional post that day, you know, afterwards, about, you know, on Instagram, because it just seemed so poignant and emblematic of kind of what I'd done and what I'd achieved. And, you know, the two guys that were in hospital with me recovering in St. Thomas's, one guy, young guy next to me, who was funnily enough from Brighton, he had a TP as well. And in the interim, both of those two had passed away, you know. I lost both of them, and we become quite good friends while we were in hospital. And I kind of looked up at the sky and just remembered them. So it was a massive massively poignant moment, you know. And I obviously was so grateful that I'd survived and had to do something like this, and I was there with my brother, and you know, it was amazing. We it's funny enough, when we got to the bottom of the mountain on that day, January 23, that month, Thailand, they'd introduced a law, if you like, but you could no longer cycle up the hill on your own, because it was so, not because of the going up, but because of coming back down, because it was so steep that people, I guess, presumably were.
You were one of the last ones to do that.
We got there, we found out we couldn't ride the bike. So we had to go on Strava, this thing, an app for, you know, athletes. And we found a guy that had done it the day before. And we said, you know, hi, we're doing this. Anything you can do? What did you do? He said, oh, I found this guy in Chiang Mai. Here's his details. So we got in touch with this guy in Chiang Mai. He said, yep, no problem. He drove like 100 kilometers to meet us. And we told him our story, right? My story. And he was kind of, and then he was like, oh, yeah, you know, and we get to the top. And as we got to the top of the mountain, and he was like in tears, you know, because he'd kind of bought into our whole story as well. So it was just this crazy, emotional, poignant moment that, you know, reaching, you know, and I'm holding my bike with the highest peak in Thailand, you know, that's the Hollywood bit. So, but yeah, so it was great. It was just, it was a real closure thing. It really helped me kind of bring everything back together and, you know, tie it all in.
But you know, Hollywood stories are based on real stories, so yeah. You know, exactly. this is the real deal. And yeah, I find it so interesting that you said you actually cycled the highest mountain, because my previous guest in this, the October shows that are being sponsored by Danzig, my first guest of this series was Lisa Murphy, and she climbed Mount Kilimanjaro with a whole lot of other women also raising awareness. And yeah, I just find it's something so important to yourself to do and accomplish, because I think once you've accomplished what you've actually set out to do, it's just the best feeling ever.
It is. I mean, it's kind of weird. It's kind of a bit cliche, isn't it? If I'm honest, you know, I've got to do something great to, you know, but that's the way it is, you know. It's just kind of like, it's almost like, because you've been hit with such a wallop in one direction, you almost feel like, at least I did, you almost feel like you needed to do something in the other direction to balance, to get some balance to things, you know, and to prove to yourself, because I wouldn't have, you know, without cancer and what I've been through, I don't think I would have ever undertaken something like that, you know. So it prompted me to do something kind of pretty cool and great, yeah, that I wouldn't have ever considered doing otherwise.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
When we get challenged, we actually realize what strength lies within us. And it doesn't always have to be the ride, like climbing the mountain or cycling up the mountain. It can be the small things. For those listening now, it's important to know that every little step is a victory in itself, because you're showing up for yourself every single day. And I know it's tough. And if you're listening now and you've been through what is the most horrific of times, there is always light at the end of the tunnel, and there is a community out there that is there to support, like this community.
No, I think that's a really good point you brought up there. You know, just because I went and did something crazy and your former, you know, interviewee did as well, it doesn't in any way lessen what anyone else does as well. It's just, that was just my crazy way of going about things, right? I think the really important thing is to just kind of, yeah, just take great pride and pleasure in the fact, and just doing things that, you know, are a challenge. And it doesn't, and even the small challenges, you know, just try and sort of get some gratification and satisfaction from that. It affects us all differently, right?
It does.
You know, like it this does. And there's no one one piece fits all type of response. But I think we all, one thing that we will all share is the fact that we are not the person we used to be.
Yeah.
And just trying to sort of find a bit of who you used to be through little achievements can be very, very balancing inside, I think, if you pursue that.
Absolutely. And when I set out to do this radio show, I had a big, well, there were a lot of questions from a lot of people. Well, why would you do and share something so intimate? And nobody talks about something like this. And I said, well, that's exactly why I have to talk about it, because nobody talks about it. I actually thought I'd come through my healing part of my journey okay.
Yeah. But
doing these interviews, speaking to people like yourself, has helped me immensely in my healing journey as well.
Yeah, I bet, hey. And you know, like, even I would imagine that even just like little parts of somebody else's story might kind of unexpectedly trigger something in you that you kind of, oh, you know, you weren't aware of, or you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just kind of think I could imagine how that might happen.
You're also not the first person with two ostomy bags on my show, because my very, very first guest. No, sorry to disappoint, but my very first guest from the States, Jolene Taylor, she is a double ostomate. She was diagnosed with a very rare cancer at the age of 3, and it was touch and go. And she ended up also with two stomas, and she ended up becoming a fashion model.
Yes, I was just about to ask you. With her, I think I've seen her. Yeah, I was on, after I had my surgery, I was on a double baggers forum on Facebook, and she was very often contributing. Yeah. And it was amazing with the stuff she's done.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then I had Andy Wakefield, and he ran not this London Marathon, but the previous one. I don't know if he ran this one, but the year before, he also ran with two bags.
I know Andy. I mean, I haven't met him in person, but I met him through this forum. And we actually had some back and forth correspondence, you know, initially.
Yeah.
But wow, that's great. Yeah.
And like you said, when somebody just hears the story that somebody else has gone through, it's comforting to know that you are not alone out there. Because I think a lot of times, especially with this kind of cancer that we've both been diagnosed with, it's one of those that people really talk about. And as soon as you do talk about it, it's basically, oh, I don't want to hear about it. And to know that there are people out there that have gone through it and are willing to talk about it, share their story openly, and actually encourage others through our story.
I think so, yeah, definitely. I mean, it can be quite a lonely place, right? And in particular, I think despite all the efforts of, you know, government, you know, campaigns and NHS campaigns, I think there is just in society, I guess understandably, a reluctance to discuss, you know, bowel habits. You know, it's all kind of tied up into our images of outward presentation and cleanliness, you know, and all that. And I think it's just an uncomfortable area for people to go. But underlying that is the sheer fact that you really it helps if you can just a little bit address the fact that it's important to be aware of this side of things, and you know, in particular, you know, don't avoid checks and things like that. And just be aware that this is a possibility, rather than, oh, that's, you know, it's too uncomfortable to think about. Yeah. And all, you know, all that happens to other people, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Those are the common phrases, you know, oh, it happens to somebody else, but not to me. No.
I mean, that's just kind of a protection mechanism, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now tell me, Ross, do you have any other challenges or adventures you're already dreaming about taking on next?
Well, I want to go back on another massive bike ride back through Thailand. I was hoping to go in January of 26, but it didn't work out. So maybe next year, but maybe do something a different route, something like that. It's funny, when I, one thing that I do have kind of wearing away in the back of my mind, just a tiny bit, I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but When I came back from my bike ride, a friend of mine said, "Hey, you know, let's catch up at the pub. I want to, you know, hear how it all went." And then, so we were, you know, having a pint or two, and he said, "You know," he said, "I've always had this crazy idea, you know, and you've made me think about this." He said, "There's this thing called the Talisker Race, and it's an across. It's basically rowing across the Atlantic Ocean." Right?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and it starts somewhere in, I think, one of the islands, like the Canary Islands or, you know, something like that. And I think it's, and it ends up in the Caribbean. I think it's probably the shortest route mm-hmm. that you can have that yeah. qualifies as crossing the Atlantic. Yeah. But still, it takes about, like, depending on your fitness levels, it takes, I think, between 2 and 3 months to do it. Wow. And so that, I'd really kind of got that into my head for a while. And oh, I don't know. It would be a massive undertaking, but my God, wouldn't that be great? Probably train for a year and you know, probably put on loads of weight because, you know, it's a pretty, and you need a very, you know, you need properly serious sponsorship because I think the boats have to be self-sustaining for 2 or 3 months, right? And mm-hmm. then, but then imagine doing that with dealing with Stoma pouches as well. So I kind of love the notion of it. Oh, I don't know.
If you can dream it, if you can dream it, it's possible.
Exactly. So I wouldn't put it beyond me, but it would just, you know, the thing is, it would take a massive kind of restructuring of life because it would have to be quite focused on doing that for probably a year of training, I would say. Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's all possible. I had Jill Castle on recently, who was the first person to swim the English Channel with a Stoma.
Yeah.
And I know the training is long and hard, and she shared, you know, there's only this short time frame where you can actually swim the channel. And I would imagine crossing the Atlantic Ocean would be the same. There's storms and things like that.
Yeah, they basically all leave in January, and even then you still don't know what you're up against.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of joining Jill in Madrid last year at the Hollister Sales Convention, and we spent a day together traveling around and hearing, you know, just, you know, a few days actually in total, but like just one day, just me and her just cruising around Madrid, and it was awesome to hear her story.
Well, she incidentally is the brainchild behind the trek to Kilimanjaro. So
yeah, I know, and our common thread, Nick, right?
Yeah.
Some of you guys watching this may not know she's our sort of contact at Hollister Danzac. And I funnily enough, coincidentally, sent her a message this morning saying, "Hey, when are you off to, you know, climb Kilimanjaro?" Mm-hmm. And she sent me back a picture. She said, "Your telepathy's working." She was just pushing off from the gate in her plane.
Yeah.
So as we speak,
she's
probably on her way she's definitely on her way to Kenya. Yeah.
Ross, we are almost at the end of the show now. In closing, could you leave listeners with one thought or piece of advice and encouragement about living boldly or the Stoma, and in your case, too? And what would that be?
Whoa, you didn't prepare me for this. Right. Right, listeners, this is completely off the top of my head. It's not staged.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think try your best to come to terms with it and do your best to challenge yourself because it's a pretty tough thing to deal with and it can easily kind of overwhelm you, you know? So I think just try and remind yourself that you're still here and there's so much that you can still do, you know?
Yeah.
You know, in a way, like to have had such a massive operation and for me to still be able to function, it's kind of crazy, right? Like, I've been thinking, like, I don't think there's too many other parts of your body where you could lose so much and actually still function quite well.
Yeah.
So just kind of remind yourself of that it's a bit of a, you know, a big pothole in the road that you've hit, but, you know, the road ahead is still clear.
Ross, thank you so much for, first of all, sharing your story so openly with us today. Your journey is really powerful, and it's a reminder that life with a stoma, in your case, two stomas, is not about limits, but about possibilities. And your courage and determination will inspire so many.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's been
Yeah.
good, great to share my story with you today. And in a way, it's interesting to kind of go through things again and remind myself that I've kind of come a long way. So yeah, well, thank you. Thank you in return.
Of course, a huge thank you to Dansac for sponsoring this special month of Stoma for Life and for the ongoing commitment to dignity, comfort, and empowering ostomates worldwide. So, to everyone listening, remember, you are not defined by your stoma. You are defined by the life you choose to live with it. Until next time, take care and keep living boldly.
Thank you very much.